You never know half of the answers to these questions, truthfully. Like, you sort of, you start with an idea. So I knew that I wanted to write an Agatha Christie story, right? That's where I started, because I said she was one of my first preoccupations. So I started, and I just wanted to write that. And I tried that when I was 21, and it was garbage, because it's almost impossible to write anything for me as a 21-year-old. I didn't have enough life experience. I wasn't very worldly. Like, I wasn't very interesting or interested in much outside of my scope of things. So there wasn't much I could add to it. So I went away and I lived my life and I traveled loads and I spent a long time away from home and I met a lot of different people. And then the seven deaths idea, I was on a plane. I was going to Qatar. I was living in Dubai, went to Qatar. And I remember very clearly it was 2 o'clock in the morning and the idea for that book just came to me fully formed. And it came with, I was going to write an Agatha Christie murder mystery. It was going to have a Groundhog Day loop and there'd be body swapping. It all came together. And I've said elsewhere, so I hope it doesn't bother people who've ever heard this, but I remember the idea was so crystal and it felt so perfect and it felt so it was going to work that I thought I'd stolen it. Like, I was completely convinced that it was someone else's idea and that I'd read it somewhere else or watched it somewhere else and enjoyed it so much that I was like, I need to look that up when I get off the plane because I will see it again. I want to watch it again or like whatever it was. I couldn't work out what it was, but I was sure it was somebody else's. So when I landed, I did. I Googled it. I looked for it. I was like, this is somebody, and I couldn't find it. So obviously then the second emotion is like, holy fuck, now I've got to go and write it.
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 105 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, MJ Kuhn. How's it going, MJ?
Hi, I am doing wonderful. How are you?
Doing good. I'm a bit nasally today because my son just like dumped a virus on me. And I'm not happy about that.
As the children tend to do.
Like literally coughing in my face, but it's okay because I'm surviving and it's all good. And I'm going to pimp my girl's books because she's the best, starting with Among Thieves, The Blue Bebe. That's the book one in the Tales of Tamor duology. And book two, Thick Ass Thieves, The Green Bebe. If you want to support MJ and her work and her cat, go pick up these two fantastic books today.
Most importantly, the
yes,
cat. Most
Thorin is key.
Also, Thorin is key. Also, you can check out my boy Adrian's book, Mushroom Blues. It is out.
I finally got my copies.
Now, so check it out for some.
After like
mushroom
6
goodness.
Weeks.
I know. I'm so excited
so
for
ridiculous.
You.
So ridiculous. Downsides of living in Ecuador. If you want shipping, go somewhere else.
You can't get packages. There's no next day Amazon shipping to Ecuador.
Fuck no. I wish, man. I wish. As well, a quick note for listeners, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live, so check the links in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app, and subscribe to the FanFiatic YouTube channel, where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And a quick shout out to our newest Patreon, patron on Patreon, David Hopkins, who supported us at $40 this month. You are absolutely amazing. Thank you so, so much. And now, welcoming today's guest, Stuart Turton, bestselling author of The 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, The Devil in the Dark Water, and his latest mindbender, The Last Murder at the End of the World. Welcome to the show, Stuart. How are you?
Hi, guys. I'm amazing. Thanks very much. How are you? Well, I can hear you sound incredible. Such joy and delight.
You sound incredible. We feel incredible.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have you on. I'm super stoked to talk to you.
Oh, well, let's see what we can do about that.
Let's just bring it down. What did Ed McDonald say? He's like, you guys are super perky or something.
Oh yeah, like peppy lines. Or whatever. I'm like, I can take peppy. I'm
perky peppy.
Yeah, that's what happens when you encounter a British dude, isn't it? And we're just like, whoa, let's just take this down a notch, all right?
People
like
are smiling all together too.
Yeah,
much.
We can't trust this. I don't know what's behind it. I've never met them and they're smiling at me. God.
Your teeth are so blinding. Get away from me.
Yeah, yeah. You can't be this happy all the time. It's suspicious, and I'll find out what's behind it.
the demons inside.
You'll solve the mystery.
Oh my God. Stuart's actually our therapist, so uncover the darkness.
Oh my God, that would be the worst job. I mean, I would enjoy it immensely, but all of my patients would end up killing themselves. And it would be terrible.
Because oh, no. Like, don't give me this job.
No, because I would be like, no, it's so much worse than you think it is. Like, that's how every therapy session would go with me. And they're like, oh no.
Most nihilistic therapist ever.
Yeah. And I would be like hiring private detectives to like get into their lives. And I'd be like, I'm so sorry. Your mental health issues aren't the problem. Your wife is cheating. That is the problem. That's what I would be. That's what I would be coming at it from.
That sounds like a true crime thriller.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. The life of every British person is a true crime thriller.
You're right.
Yeah. It's your next story premise, maybe.
Before we dig deeper into the episode, a quick word from our sponsor.
Strap in for a fast-paced heist that rockets through the gritty void of outer space. Chloe's Kingdom by Gregory Michael is a pulse-pounding sci-fi adventure that keeps readers on their toes from start to finish. Let's dive right into the story. Chloe Espinoza is a wild-haired petty thief aboard the Kingdom, a drifting city spaceship. Once rich but now poor, Chloe is determined to break free from the honeycombs and return to her life in the gardens. Only one problem. She hardly has enough coin for her burrito, making a lavish apartment seem as distant as the stars. All that might change, however, when Chloe is offered a heist that could make her unimaginably rich. But she can't break into the impenetrable coin vault alone. We have a young mastermind who can't let go of her past, a mathematical genius in desperate need of coin, a privileged kid from the gardens with a debt to pay, a bartender who's serving revenge, a mischievous raccoon with bottomless appetite, and a battered soul who's been wronged by the council. Their plan? To rob the treasury and bring down the corrupt council. But in a game where the stakes are jail or death, every move could be their last. A top 15 Amazon bestseller and number 2 in hot new releases, Chloe's Kingdom is packed with heart-stopping action, mind-bending twists, and an unforgettable adventure through the stars. This is a must-read for fans of sci-fi and heist thrillers. Chloe's Kingdom is available now exclusively on Amazon, free on Kindle Unlimited, or you can grab your copy on Kindle, paperback, or hardcover today.
And now, enjoy the rest of this episode of SFF Addicts. All right, well, with that introduction, we'll get a little bit deeper. For people who aren't familiar with you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Yeah, so my name's Stu Turton. I am British, as we've already covered. What else is interesting about me? Not very much. I am 44. I've got two small children. I live just north of London in a very bucolic little village, which doesn't allow me. You do walk out the door and you absolutely know all of these people are up to something, right? Like, it's one of those places where, like,
there's no anonymity.
No, there's none. And there are secrets behind every door. You know there are. Like, people are cheating. Like, people are being unhappy. But outside, they're all smiling and happy. So that's very fertile ground for writing. Before this, I was a travel journalist. Before that, I was a technology journalist. And then I had the idea for my first book, The 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, when I was working in Dubai. And then I immediately left that job in Dubai, flew all the way back to the UK and started writing that insane novel because I needed rain in the British class system, because that's what that is. It's an Agatha Christie, a nutso Agatha Christie novel. So, and that's kind of where all the author stuff sort of began. Does that cover it? I'm so dull. I was digging for nuggets of interest.
Something. You are a fan of milk. As we covered before we started recording.
As we covered in our pre-interview.
Yeah. This makes it sound like I've got like a little altar to milk, and that's not the case. It's just I enjoy a spot of milk and we'll travel for good milk. That's really...
Okay.
But I like to believe that's at least two-thirds of our population.
Yeah. At least in the UK. A spot of milk.
A spot of milk.
Yeah.
Again, yes. Anything for the perfect cup of tea, the correct milk in the correct amount.
It's a science. There's a science to it. I love it. Well, we got a little into your origin story with moving back to the UK to write that that first novel to have the rain and the class system. I love that answer. but let's dive a little more into your origin story in terms of your consumption of fiction, let's say. So we like to talk about the kind of gateway drug to fantasy, sci-fi, fiction books. Do you remember the books, movies, games, shows, anything like that, that first captivated you when you were younger and made you interested in fiction?
Yeah, I remember. I can chart my path very succinctly because each sort of bit of it has been has inspired a different book that I've written. So almost tracking exactly to what fascinated me growing up. So I got into reading with Roald Dahl, first of all, and then Agatha Christie. So that's where it started. And Agatha Christie was the person who taught me about death very seriously. I loved her books, and my next door neighbor kept bringing these books to me when I was about 8 years of age. And I've been very lucky. No one in my family had died. I'd never come across it. And then I read them all between about 8 and 12 or something like that. And then my next door neighbor just died and stopped bringing them. And then that was, my parents were like, well, you know, she's dead. And I was like, I don't know what that means. What's this? What's all this about? Because it'd been in the books, but it didn't mean anything. It was like, they were just people who had to die so you could have an interesting story that followed. So I went through the Agatha Christie, and then I came through Agatha Christie and went dark. I went to like Stephen King, and I went into horror. And then I lightened up and started reading Terry Pratchett. And then I got into sort of like 70s sci-fi, so John Wyndham-y stuff, Dune, like everybody else, that sort of path. And I came out of that and started reading literary fiction. And what you've got to realize as we talk and through that little brief introduction is that crime features fuck all anywhere in it, which is really interesting as a man who became a crime author, that there was, apart from the Agatha Christie and a bit of Conan Doyle, I never went back to crime. Like I've never devoured crime in any sort of like, it's never been one of my preoccupations.
What about in like television or movies and stuff like that?
Oh, Groundhog Day, a show called Quantum Leap. I don't know if you remember that back in the day. And I know they've remade it, but I've not caught that. But back in the day, there was Quantum Leap, Star Trek, Doctor Who, all the goodies, all the biggies, anything that had a big idea. I was fascinated with big ideas. I always liked that more than, I wasn't that bothered by there being a starship, if that made sense. I wasn't that bothered about there being a time machine. I was bothered with the ideas that those things could interact with, like, and the strangeness of the stories they could tell and the structural things they could do with the stories. And I remember even as a kid, the episodes of Doctor Who I loved were the ones where they would bump into themselves, where they would suddenly, a couple of doctors would be there interacting with each other and how they wouldn't get along. I loved that. I thought that was an astonishing idea. So it was stuff like that that always sort of like drew my attention. Like I always loved anything that got really weird really quickly.
And again, with the movies and TV, like a distinct lack of like crime.
Yeah, but you can see the time, I know, and stuff that comes into 7.5 deaths for sure. The things you were loving.
But how
but it's interesting because
how did you end up like writing that stuff though? Like 7.5 deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. Obviously it takes like the class system that you're so fond of. And I think like, and kind of like the influences from Agatha Christie, that is very much present. But then like, how did all the rest of it, because it's such like an intricate plot and you know, you're kind of going deep into the sort of like murder mystery aspect of it. How did all that come to be?
Do you know what? Like, you guys know this, you write. You never know half of the answers to these questions, truthfully. Like, you sort of, you start with an idea. So I knew that I wanted to write an Agatha Christie story, right? That's where I started, because I said she was one of my first preoccupations. So I started, and I just wanted to write that. And I tried that when I was 21, and it was garbage, because it's almost impossible to write anything for me as a 21-year-old. I didn't have enough life experience. I wasn't very worldly. Like, I wasn't very interesting or interested in much outside of my scope of things. So there wasn't much I could add to it. So I went away and I lived my life and I traveled loads and I spent a long time away from home and I met a lot of different people. And then the seven deaths idea, I was on a plane. I was going to Qatar. I was living in Dubai, went to Qatar. And I remember very clearly it was 2 o'clock in the morning and the idea for that book just came to me fully formed. And it came with, I was going to write an Agatha Christie murder mystery. It was going to have a Groundhog Day loop and there'd be body swapping. It all came together. And I've said elsewhere, so I hope it doesn't bother people who've ever heard this, but I remember the idea was so crystal and it felt so perfect and it felt so, it was going to work, that I thought I'd stolen it. Like, I was completely convinced that it was someone else's idea and that I'd read it somewhere else or watched it somewhere else and enjoyed it so much that I was like, I need to look that up when I get off the plane. because I will see it again. I want to watch it again, or like whatever it was. I couldn't work out what it was, but I was sure it was somebody else's. So when I landed, I did. I Googled it. I looked for it. I was like, this is somebody, and I couldn't find it. So obviously then the second emotion is like, holy fuck, now I've got to go and write it, which is the last thing I sort of really want to do. Because it is, even at that sort of little log line phrase.
Into this, I have to do it.
It was, because it was like, it's so complicated and it's going to be so hard to do. And that it really was. It was all of those things. And I knew even at that moment that I was going to go home and have a very complicated conversation with my girlfriend, now wife, because we were living in Dubai and we were having a great time. We were travel journalists. We traveled 2 weeks of every month. It genuinely was and still is to this day the best job in the world. But I was so obsessed by this idea. I knew that I would be restless and I wouldn't sleep ever again until I wrote it. And I knew I genuinely had to do it in the UK. That's everything around me needed to be Agatha Christie-esque, and I couldn't do it in Dubai. You can't do it with skyscrapers and desert. You can't write that book there. So that's how that all came into being. But yeah, and then as you know, once you write that book was successful. So then everyone's like, oh, you're a crime author now. That's just the way this works. Like, you become a crime author. I didn't start off as a crime author. I wanted to write this book, this one book, and then I'm a crime author. So that's why I've carried on writing crime. And that's why my crime books constantly have aspects of other things I love in them. So science fiction or a haunted boat for my second one. Anything else that fascinates me now, different genres sort of gets grafted into my crime books.
Yeah, I love that. I love the way that you blend genres together. And I did the same thing for mine. It was like this, like, your head is just this blender of all these disparate influences that you've consumed over the entirety of your life. And then you vomit it out into this story or this idea. And that's like exactly what you went through, where you're just like, shit, did I steal that? And it's like, maybe I kind of like co-opted a bunch of ideas from different things and then mashed it together afterwards, you know? But I think like the difficult part is like taking something like that and then just actually fleshing it out. And so, you know, like for me and MJ, she's much more of like a heavy duty kind of like outliner plotter than I am. I'm somewhere sort of in the middle. But how did you take like an idea like that, or for all of your books, really, like how do you take those ideas and then build it out into something tangible? Like, do you plot it, or are you more like pantsing the whole experience?
For 7.5 deaths, like that book is so super intricate, complicated, and there are so many time loops within time loops, and it's I have to imagine you plotted that ahead of time. How did that work?
I did, but there's a mechanical trick at the center of 7.5 deaths, which not a lot of people notice, but it's that it is a fairly bog standard murder mystery. All that is happening is, instead of Poirot going to the witness and then having the witness tell you what happened in the past tense, you are seeing it in the first person. That's it. That's the only real difference. And once you start thinking of that book like that, it becomes a lot simpler to imagine how it was plotted out, because it was plotted out like any other murder mystery. It's just that my Poirot is the character that my hope, like, you know, that Aiden is inhabiting that day. So he's sort of shifting through detectives, but all he's doing is experiencing the witness statements for himself. That's really all it is. And then I just had to chop those up into interesting bits. That was the difficult part, was, you know, because you don't get an entire witness statement, but you never do in an Agatha Christie anyway. Like, you get a bit of it and there's a lie, and then he gets some more information and he goes back and he uncovers that bit that's a lie. And then, you know, and he uses that to get more information out of other people. I was just doing that, but all in the first person. So it's actually not that, it is very intricate. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to, but I'm very, very stupid. And what is crucial about this is that everyone looks at that book and thinks that you had to be a mastermind to write it. You didn't. You just had to slightly shift your perspective just a little bit, just to the left. So that's what I did. I just, as I say, I did it all in first person, and then I chopped it up, and then I put it back down on the page, and then I just drafted it over and over and over and over and over again. There was like 30 drafts of that novel. It kept changing. The ending changed at the last minute. There was an extra character in it until sort of like until the past 6 months or something, you know? Like, it really was just an incremental process of making it better and better, and just making sure that the audience was there with me, because you have to toe that line. And again, you guys know this, you have to toe that line sometimes of the book being intricate and complex, but making the promise to the reader that as long as they stay with you, it will be explained. And they'll be okay. It's okay to feel lost because eventually you won't feel lost. So a lot of my readers who hate Seven Deaths, which is about 50% of everyone who reads it, they hate it for that. It's just one of those books. It's so Marmite-y. But the people who like it really love it, and the people who hate it truly hate it. It's just what it is. And they hate it because they don't like feeling lost. They don't like not having a handhold for 10,000, 15,000 words. And they let me know very vociferously that that's what they feel about
but that, but that's kind of like the balance you have to play when it comes to mysteries and crime novels and stuff like that, is like, how much do you pull them along? How do you balance promise versus payoff and those kinds of things?
Trusting what do you your reveal reader at what too. Time?
Yeah. Which when do you incorporate lies and versus when do you tell them the truth and those kinds of things? I think Marmite is like the best.
I've never heard that.
The best description for like,
so
this is a divisive book. It's fucking Marmite. Yeah. That is amazing. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. No, that is completely it. It is total Marmite. And that was baked into the premise of it. It was, when I wrote that book, what I've got now is I've got a reader base who trusts me because they know that I'm going to do this. Like, three books in now, if you've read all my books, you know that you're going to be lost for a good proportion of it, and then I will see you right at the end or see you right at some point. And all my books are a power fantasy about, this is a world you don't understand, but as you go through the book, you'll accumulate the knowledge to begin to understand how to solve this mystery for yourself. I've got those people now. I didn't have them for Seven Deaths, and then most people didn't know what kind of author I was going to be. They didn't know what kind of experience I was going to give them. They didn't know whether I could pay off what I was asking of them, which is a lot. There's a lot of characters. There's a lot of clues. There's a lot of little mini mysteries. And then you're trying to work out the world. You're trying to work out why this body swapping is happening. So I completely understand those people in those early days who didn't get along with it and didn't trust it and sort of fell away from it. Because I was asking 130,000 words, huge time commitment. But hopefully, you know, if you didn't like that one, I can get you back on for the Haunted Boat book, which is a bit simpler, or the post-apocalyptic sort of dystopian, utopian murder mystery. That's the idea. At some point, I'll be like, hey, maybe this other book will suit you because they're all completely different.
Well, that's the fun thing about having a bunch of standalones, right? Well, and, you know, Adrian and I were talking the other day that I was like, I will get anything you write forever because I just like your prose style. I like how you describe things. So, but another thing I really love.
Are you talking to me or Adrian now? I'm trying to work out whose ego. Oh, great. Again, as a British dude, I couldn't take that compliment. I was like, she's talking to Adrian. It's really weird that she's doing it.
She didn't name me.
I name dropped you in the conversation. Yeah. But yeah,
she's just like, Adrian, I'll just buy anything you ever write.
Right?
From
well, that's true too. But no, I.
More like I love I'll send you my proofs forever.
But Stuart, I literally, as I'm reading your books, and this is something I've told people when I recommend them to my friends and family, is like, there are times, so many times, where I will just read the way you've described something and I have to like sit back a second and go, that was really clever. But another thing that you do so well with your work is your character development. And you've mentioned here that you have a large cast of characters, and that's very true I haven't had the pleasure of reading your latest yet, but for both
it also has a big cast. Yes.
Oh, I am storming off. I am out of here. This is a disgrace.
But for both that and
fuck your post-apocalypse.
Devil and the Dark Waters. You have a large cast of characters, but the character development still shines really well. And I just want to know, what is your advice for writers to help make a character jump off the page immediately? Because yours do. Within the first like paragraph that you meet them, you're like, oh, I know what this person's about a little bit, or I'm interested to find out what this person's about. What's your advice for that?
Oh, I always try to introduce a character with a single scene, which is going to tell you everything about them. So I'm trying to catch them in a moment of action. So something's happened, and then they all have to react to it. And in that moment, immediately, you can see who they are. And in a moment where they can't really think about it too much, you know, like they can't sort of overcomplicate it. They just react, and then you get them straight away. And I always try and do that with characters. And the second thing I do when I'm writing characters, I find for me, when I'm writing them, if I don't want to go back to them, they're not working. If I'm not happy to spend time with them, they're not working. If I overwrite them, they're not working. So the people who I'm, the characters in my books are the ones who survived, because I will cull characters at a moment's notice. If I plan 10 characters and only three of them are working, I will kill seven of them. Like, just in the planning straight away after, like, and I will talk about this and we'll probably come up later, but I usually throw away the first draft of my novels completely. Like, I don't save any of it. So Last Murder was 111,000 word draft. That went, Seven Deaths was 97,000 words, and Devil in Dark Water was 130,000 words. And those drafts were tossed. All of it was just got wiped. And because for me, that's how where I'm finding the characters. Usually those books, those drafts will have the wrong protagonist. They will have the wrong mystery sometimes, or the wrong ending. They will be worried about the wrong things, uninteresting things, or they will be, in the case of Last Murder, the most pretentious shite that anybody's ever written, because the conceit for Last Murder in that first draft was so ridiculous and so sort of author toss that, like, nobody was ever going to read it. It was dreadful. And it took me a year to get through it and to work it out and get to the end of it and be like, oh, God, no one's ever going to see that. Thank God. And send that away. So usually in the process of doing that, I'll discover which characters are working for me and who I'm interested in and, you know, what I want. So Emery, in Last Murder, the book I'm on now, Emery wasn't the central character of that for a year and a half. Like, she got promoted. In Devil, there's a character called Sarah who is almost like the co-lead investigator. She wasn't. She was chief among suspects for 2 years of writing that. So it was always a case of, who am I interested in as I write this? Who do I want to keep going back to? Who do I want to spend time with? Who do I want to write more dialogue with and put them in a room with more characters? Oh, it's that person. All right, well, that's probably the lead of my book then. So it's weird, hard work happenstance.
No, but I love how it comes full circle, and then you realize your process now. Because I think that's one of the trickiest things as a writer is fighting with your process. And, you know, if your process is throwing out your first draft, that's totally fine. Like, we've had authors on in the past and they call it like, this is my shit draft, this is my zero draft. Because it's like, this is the thing that is for fleshing out ideas and figuring out what works. And it is expendable if it needs to be.
Or the description, like, I've heard once, you're gathering sand in your first draft, and then the subsequent drafts are where you build your sandcastle, right? Yeah. Like, just gather.
You don't have to use all the sand in your sandcastle either.
No, I usually, my thing is usually that's where I'm building my bricks, and then the bricks build the house sort of thing. But what is interesting about that process, I think, is that it makes sense. I initially thought it was a mistake. So there was always things happening in my life when I write books. So for Seven Deaths, it didn't matter. I had a job and, you know, I had a full-time proper professional job. And I was writing that on the side. So it kind of didn't matter how long it took or how many mistakes it made, because there was no deadline. For the second one, I just had my baby girl, my first daughter, while I was writing Devil. So I blamed her for absolutely everything that went wrong in that novel. You know, I had this little baby. She was keeping me up at night. And of course, I couldn't write well or couldn't write coherently. That's entirely her fault. So she was the reason I had to throw away the first draft. And then when it got to Last Murder and I was making all the mistakes I'd made before, I was like, oh, maybe I'm the problem. Maybe it wasn't that sort of two-month-old baby. Yeah, well, I had another one, just as like a control in an experiment. I had a second child during Last Murder. And I made all the same mistakes. So you're right. I think wrestling with the process, but I think from outside this business, and it is a job, it seems really weird that you would expend so much labor on something that is expendable. Like we say, it's like building a big house that you never intend to live in. But it is a feature of it. And I think it does scare away a lot of people who think, actually, I've written it and I've done all the hard work and it has to mean something. I have to sell it. It has to get published. Otherwise, what was the point of it? They don't see it as the first step towards the book you will eventually have. And I think when people talk about, like, how did you get here? How did you become an author? What did you do? And it's like, I recognize that had to happen. That's the bit of this that is the job. It's not the writing down words. It's the discipline to know that most of those words will be dog shit.
And then getting them to the point where the people who read the book at the end don't realize all the dog shit that you tossed away in order
to make that thing. They see the beauty of it. Yeah, they don't see all the hard work. That's making it look effortless is the is the trick.
Yeah, I'm still not sure I do that, to be honest. Like, if you've got 130,000 words, I think there's always going to, you're going to feel the effort somewhere in the center of that. Because, like, you're like, I've been reading this for 9 years. Why is this happening?
But the thing, what you said about your baby, I went through a similar thing with my writing. Because I started writing and podcasting after I had my first kid. And then I had another kid when I started writing Mushroom Blues. And there are so many days where I'm just like, God damn it, like, you're the one to blame. And it's like being a little crotchety piece of shit and blame him. But then it's like, yeah, it's part of the process. Also part of the process of being a parent, part of the process of being a writer, and just figuring out like, oh yeah, it's all me. It's all my ego.
Yeah. And I think like a big part of it as well is that you've got to accept that life isn't one thing. Life can't just be about writing. Like, sometimes I think that would be lovely if I could just go away and put myself in a bubble and just write and focus on the things I want to focus on. Life is never going to be that. It's never going to give you that unless you're something goes horribly wrong, truthfully. And I think the moment which you got that dream just to be left alone and write, you would realize that you'd fucked your life up completely, probably. So life is about, you know, children and partners and parents and friends having crises and dogs and cats and things that screw up your day. And being able to sort of get through those things and take something from them that helps your writing is going to be a big part of it, because you're never, ever going to be left alone. Like, something will always try and knock you sideways.
I completely agree. And speaking of being knocked sideways, The Devil in the Dark Water, taking place on a ship, and, you know, I...
What a link!
Adrian is the master of the transitions, as you will discover.
That was amazing. Looking in his eyes for the last 5 minutes, seeing the cogs turning, being like, I think it's coming. Oh my God. I feel it.
No, I've just been doing this for years, so I know how to throw down those badass segues. But something that like MJ and I really love about that book and Evelyn Hardcastle as well is like the way... Obviously, you're digging into sort of like your love for Agatha Christie with the sort of historical settings and stuff like that. Devil in the Dark Water feels a lot more like historical fiction, but obviously with that huge horror and mystery aspects to it. But when it comes to research, because this is honestly something that I kind of hate, like I don't enjoy research all that much. But when it comes to historical settings and stuff like that, I feel like there are a lot of things that you have to balance in order to get those details right. And how did you approach that? And are there ways that you feel that authors could, you know, approach research and world building a little bit more efficiently in order to get those details right without getting too bogged down on like all that historical baggage? Because the historical baggage is like is something that I feel like I would probably get too caught up in personally.
The first thing I'm going to say here is basically, if you're listening to me for advice, you have gone very wrong. That should be a base level. That is like little like text at the bottom of my life. Everywhere I go, that should be, do not listen to this man. He cannot be trusted. That's what I need. Yeah, like, do not take advice from this man.
Just a spot of milk and ignore everything.
Yeah, exactly. I tell my own children that when I'm telling them off. Like, she's 5 and a half, my daughter. I'm like, you shouldn't do that, but also you probably shouldn't listen to me. So maybe go and ask your mom, because...
But I just instill so much confidence.
That's it. Like, I know where I stand on the tier of parenting, and it's nowhere near the top. I am a middling parent at best. But historical research, I love research. I like research where I'm active. So I don't like research where I have to sit down in front of the same computer where I'll be writing the book. So when I'm researching, I'm not generally sitting down Googling things. I very much avoid that because I find that tedious. So when I was researching Devil, I had a whale of a time because I traveled loads. So I went over to Amsterdam, because in Amsterdam they'd rebuilt the boat, because Devil in Dark Water is based on a true story. I fictionalized it loads and added loads to it, but at heart there was a true story in that. And that was about a shipwreck off the coast of Australia. And in Amsterdam, they rebuilt that boat that was shipwrecked off the coast of Australia. So you could go there and climb around there and just be on it and then really bug the volunteers for information, right? You could just ask them questions. And I used to be a journalist for years, so talking to people and annoying them is my gravy. This is how it is the best thing I will ever do with my day, is to slightly irk strangers. That is what I want to do.
And then write it down.
And then write it down.
Record it. Yeah.
No, I'd often frequently have so much fun irking them that I forget to write it down, right? And then have to go back and irk them all over again. But I'm constantly trained to, I'm in this office. This is where I write my books. My books take me 2 years to write, roughly. I don't want to be in this office when I'm researching. I want to be out in the world, talking to people, climbing around things. So I always try and do research that gives me that opportunity. And also, I don't know if it's the same there, but in the UK, you can write that off on tax. So, you know, it's a very excellent perk of being an author.
In the US, I think there are a lot of, at least in Canada, I know as well, but like there are certain things that you can qualify as like a work expense as a writer.
Yeah, precisely. So like you can book that flight and go to that place and charge your meals and just say, hey, look, this is research for a book. So you've got that incentive to go out and do it. There was a bit with Devil where I had to come back, and then I went to the British Library and sat in the British Library. And in the British Library, you can get this sort of researcher pass. And once you've got it, the staff can't do enough nice things for you. So you'll say to them, hey, look, I need a load of like ship manifests from 1694. And they will go away for half an hour and then come back with a stack of ship manifests from 1694. Amazing. It's incredible. And then, so even if you don't like research, you will enjoy that level of power over another human being. Like that is just, I would inventing things to send them.
Forget about research. It's all about lording over other people.
Yeah.
Like, what's the weirdest thing I can ask them for?
Right. It gets to that point where you're just like, I never want to leave here because nobody else does the things I ask them to do. Right. So.
And at the same time, they come back with a manifest and you're like, boom, there's like every character name I need for this entire book.
That was what it was. Yeah. I took, that's where all the names came from, ship manifest from that era. All the spellings, everything came from that. So I love the research for it, but it was principally because I know my limitations. I know what bores me. I know what I don't want to be doing. And then I use the research to go in the opposite direction because I hate writing. I hate it. I hate the act of it. I hate sitting down in front of a computer for 8 hours a day. It drives me absolutely wild. It really does kill me. So I spend 3 months doing research and I give myself that holiday before the book starts. And the first day that the research ends and the book starts, it's like a man walking to the guillotine. Like it's honestly, you've never seen a human being be so sad. Yeah.
Oh, because you know that there's a whole first draft ahead of you that you're going to throw.
Yeah, away. That you're going to throw away.
No, because I know that after the first draft's thrown away, I still have to go and write another. Because for me, the book mostly is in my head by that point. I have a fair idea of who these people are and what it sort of looks like and roughly where the ending is and all that sort of stuff. And I've done my research. So it's kind of like every day is repeating a thing that I've already done. And sometimes you're just trying to express it on the page in a way that will never be as elegant as the way it is in your head. And it's just that annoying process of there's something inexact about the language and the keyboard versus what your imagination could just whip up in 20 seconds. And it can take me a month to get exactly that 20 seconds out. And it just drives me insane. It's so exasperating and inefficient. I want one of those VR helmets that kind of sucks the imagination out of me and just like puts it somewhere else. But that's how I find it really, really tough. So yeah, I love the research bits because it is the bit before I do the bit that I don't enjoy.
Yeah, as a fellow first draft hater, I feel your pain acutely there. But I love that. I love that approach to research too, as you know, you're following the leads and the things that fascinate you. Because then it's going to make it easier to translate into something that will be fascinating details on the page to your reader. I think that's a super cool approach to it. To dive a little more into Devil, I want to talk a little bit about kind of some of the themes that are in there, because there's a lot of themes in Devil in the Dark Water about faith, superstition, rationality, right? All these different characters are kind of exploring the mystery and the kind of supernatural things that seem to be happening different ways. So first of all, what drew you to these themes? Were you drawn to them before you began drafting? Are they things that just kind of emerged through the writing process? And if you could pick like one thing for readers to take away from the story or pick up on, what do you hope that is?
I'll do the second question first because it applies to all my novels, which is that I genuinely do believe in the death of the author, that when you hand the book over, you're done. Your job is over. My only job exists then is to sell my book to people. I become a salesman at that point. Like, I'm no longer the author of that novel. I did that job. That job is over. So once a reader picks up the book, it's all their imagination. It's me feeding sort of the film into the projector in their head, right? And then they are creating their own movie out of it, and they're seeing it completely different to the way the next person will read that book. So when they hand it to their mum or their dad, their brother, their sister, their partner, that person will see it completely differently. And there is a magic to that that I do not want to get in the way of. So I very rarely answer questions about, you know, do you think this person felt that or that? What do you think happened when this story ended? What do you think the true motivation? Like, I don't answer those because that's up to you. That's a reader thing. So for me, what I want you to take away from the novel is whatever you took away from the novel. That's why they're so dense. That's why they're packed so tight. It's a huge trunk, and you can take anything out of that trunk you want and enjoy it however you want to enjoy it, unless you're waving it around at a Trump rally. I'll probably disagree then, but roughly, you can take anything you want out of my novels, and Godspeed. That's what it's there for.
Make Evelyn great again.
Make Evelyn great again. Make Evelyn live again, is that entire...
Yeah, there we go.
There we go.
Yeah. I'd get that on a cap. but the themes of the novels are always... I think there's something about that as well. I don't know about you guys. I don't start off thinking about themes. Like, they're not part of my planning process. And that's the annoying thing, I think, about writing sometimes, is that you try to hold yourself back from it a little bit. You try to write in a... I do. I try to write in a different voice every time. I try to sort of change my characters a lot so they have different motivations, that they're bothered by different things. And yet somehow the things that are bugging me at the time always turn up in the novels, always. And I think... So the big example in Seven Deaths, the first novel, was that... That all that stuff about the class system, I joke about needing that, but I was surprised by how vitriolic I got about it in the novel, because I feel that way about inherited wealth. I feel that way about the upper class, but that's what Agatha Christie always did, and I thought I'd made my peace with it because it was one of the tropes of her book. And then I get to it and dismantle it, and all those characters are terrible, and all those characters are awful, and all the servants are lovely and helpful and kind and basically northern like me. And it was so obvious. Like, it drove me insane. And then when I get to Devil, it is an entire deconstruction of the capitalist system. Like, that entire novel is about the foundations and sort of capitalism going professional, right? Up until that point, it'd been relatively amateur, and then it becomes professional when these massive companies are formed in the East Indies and the trading spices back and forth and making a lot of people very wealthy at the expense of many more people. And I was surprised to get to the end of that novel and realize how bothered by that I clearly was, and sort of how I'd expressed that in the novel. But I think I chose that story because it was based on a true story, and I was excited by the true story, which I'd come across when I was backpacking around in Australia. And I liked that story, and I liked the time period, and I liked it was on the cusp of modern technology, right? So it's on the cusp of our society becoming recognisable to us. Because before this, before, I can't remember that novel set, like 1632 or something, but before that, it is truly barbaric, and we wouldn't have understood. We could have been dropped into society and we'd all be dead in about a day because we would not be able to operate. We wouldn't understand how this society functioned. And sort of post that, in the decades that follow that, it becomes a bit more recognisable to us. We'd still be dead of diseases and all sorts of things, but we'd at least understand how to make a transaction. We'd at least understand how to get a thing from another human being. We could start to pick up the language because it gets a bit more formalised. So that story attracted me. That's why I went and wrote it. The themes just come out of me and my stupid maelstrom head.
Yeah, but it's like you said, like, the things that preoccupy us come out inherently through just the process and the act of, like, doing it. It's like these characters become forced into becoming our little soapboxes on their own individual levels, and even though they want to do it or not, it's like, you will do it. But then over the course of revision, then you can sort of, like, maybe pick up on those things and refine it so it doesn't seem so blatant or preachy or anything like that.
And I usually try and take it out when it's really nailed on to me.
Too obvious.
Yeah, because I think there's something to me that's a little bit lazy about that. Like, I am trying to, from the beginning of a thing, I'm trying to craft a character who feels individual, feels unique from me, feels distinct from me. If I allow myself the shortcut of just giving them things I think and giving them words that I would say, which I know is daft because they obviously are things I think and are things I think, but you understand what I'm trying to get to. I'm not schizophrenic, I promise. But like, I want them to feel, I do want them to feel distinct, and I don't want to allow myself that thing of being like, oh, I'm a bit stuck today, but I think this, so they can probably think that. Like, I never want that to be the case. I always try to think about what was their goal, what was their motivation, what is the challenge they're facing, what background does this person come out of, so what would they be feeling at this minute? I generally do want the rigor of that, and I do enjoy the rigor of that. So yeah, it generally sort of does bother me when I go back to a book a year later, and I never read my books again, but people point things out, and I'll go back and read the page, and I'll be like, oh, for fuck's sake, like, that is just me on the page. That's infuriating. I worked so hard. You just can't help it.
It slips through regardless. Yeah. So how about your newest book, The Last Murder at the End of the World, in terms of like how you came up with the story and why you chose a post-apocalypse? Because everything you've done before this, it's like you've kind of dabbled in history more so than anything. But this is very distinctly sci-fi, you know, post-apocalyptic. There's like a fog that has destroyed much of the earth, and it's like a very, very cool setting, but then you confine that into a very singular space. So what drew you to a post-apocalypse this time around, and if you could tell people a little bit more about the book as well?
Oh yeah, so the novel is set 90 years after the world has ended, so everybody died, we're all dead, everyone we love is dead. I'm so sorry about that.
Deal with it.
Yeah, just deal with it. But 122 people have survived, and they're living on a small Greek island. The island is surrounded by a barrier, and that's what's keeping the fog at bay, and the fog is the thing that's killed everybody else. And it is I described this to my publisher when I first pitched it as dystopian utopia. So like, the world ended, but the people who survived are having a great time. Like, there is no violence. There is no murder. There's no pushing or shoving. They barely have arguments. They are selfless.
It feels very much like Aldous Huxley, kind of like, at least at the beginning, before things get a little bit more horrific.
Yeah, exactly. And it is, that was like one of my inspirations, but I'll get back to that. The things going in was, I wanted this to feel like, often you see dystopia and it's like a Cormac McCarthy thing. It's the road, it's people, you know, eating babies. And I didn't want that. I wanted the idea that these people have become the best versions of themselves. It is a dystopia that you've not seen before, where everyone is generally quite happy. But there are oddities on the island. They have a voice in their head that hears all their thoughts, and it's guiding them towards being selfless and kind. They have a curfew, so wherever they are at night, at 6:30, they just fall asleep. Whatever they're doing, they fall asleep, so they better be in bed. And there's bits of the island they can't go to. So there's lots of secrets and mysteries on the island, and there's lots of things for them to puzzle over, but they don't. And that's one of the interesting things about these people. They, curiosity's sort of been bred out of them, except for Emery, who's our protagonist, and she is curious, and she does have questions, and she is bothered by things. And that's sort of made her a pariah in this little lovely outcast society, until one of them turns up dead one morning, and then it's up to the person who asks questions to work out why this has happened and how this could possibly happen on the island. So to go back to your earlier thing, that's like a précis of the novel, but it was because all my novels are reactions against the previous novel. So I write seven deaths, so seven and a half deaths, keep calling it seven deaths, but seven and a half deaths in the US. And everybody wants me to write the eight deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, and then preferably the nine deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, because that's the way the industry works, right? You write something that works and is a hit, and then they'd like you to do it again. And Devil was my way of telling everyone to fuck off. My way, it was just like, I am not going to do that. I have no intention of writing the eight deaths or the nine deaths. That's not what I'm going to do. What I'm going to do is write a historical haunted ship book instead. So that's, and then I did that, and it jarred a lot of people, but it worked. I think everybody was like, hang on a minute, he's going to veer a lot. And then after I'd written that, well, I don't want to be in 1632 anymore, and I've done the 1920s, so where am I going to go? I don't particularly want to write something contemporary, so we're going in the future. And that's honestly the conversation I have with myself. It's like, well, how far in the future? What's that future look like? And I'm plotting a murder mystery, and I It sounds a weird thing to say in a sci-fi podcast. I didn't want this to be too sci-fi because I wasn't comfortable operating in that space. I think if I go sci-fi, I want to go full balls out sci-fi. Huge ideas, space opera, massive technology, all the good stuff, right? Like, what could our world look like in 200 years? I kind of want to get to that. My publisher wasn't going to accept that. I wasn't comfortable writing it. So I went for something smaller. I went for a future where most of that technology has been lost, but there are people who remember it. So I can still talk about it. I can still hint at it. I can still have the flavor of it. And then when I got to that, for a murder mystery novel, for me especially, a murder mystery novel needs to be contained. It's just a mechanical thing about writing them. You can't have the characters coming and going because otherwise there's no reason why your murderer would stick around. Makes no sense. They would just leg it. That's the way that should work. So I've written a locked house novel. That was my first one. Then I wrote a locked boat novel. That was my second one. And this is my locked island novel. I just keep inventing reasons to keep these people contained. That's where the fog came from. So it's very mechanical. And then I've got to work out why there's a fog. What did that do? And then we get the world overtaken. And when I went to my publisher with all of this, I was like, well, imagine if John Wyndham had written an Agatha Christie novel. That's sort of what we'll be aiming at. And then you do, when you start writing this stuff, you do, as you talked about Aldous Huxley earlier. Yes, it's Aldous Huxley. It's John Wyndham. It's all of those authors from, and that's why the cover, when people see the cover, it's why it looks like it does. It's got pastels on it. It's very 70s sci-fi. And it's because it's referencing that period. It's referencing those sorts of ideas, that idea of a utopian humanity that maybe isn't as utopian and what we had to give up for that utopia. It's all about that sort of stuff. So that's an incredibly, I just realized how long I've been talking for. Like, I realized that my voice is the only voice I've heard
since
2002.
You're excited to talk about it.
Oh my god.
Oh my gosh. Also, though, our listeners have come to this episode to hear you talk, not to hear us talk. Yeah. So that's perfect.
They definitely have not. They have no idea who I am, and they're still trying to work out what this accent is. It is, and I will fill you
that
in.
That is the true mystery. No.
Yes, that is. It's Ringo Starr from the Beatles. That's who you think I sound like, just in case anyone's wondering. Save you a lot of time.
Oh my god. Several listeners just went, ah, that's it.
Got it. Yeah. Thomas the Tank Engine. Yes.
Yeah. Oh my god, dude. That is a deep cut. Gosh. That is a deep cut.
Yes. Well, no, that was, I was already excited to read this book, and now I'm even more excited to read it, having heard your description of it. But what were some of the challenges, or did you, I mean, I'm assuming you ran into challenges writing a book, because writing a book is hard, and we all run into challenges. What were some of the challenges that you ran into writing this one, and was it more challenging in certain ways? Because I'm thinking, you know, with your research process being so immersive, when you went and walked the ship, right, that is the setting for Devil in the Dark Water, and with Last Murder at the End of the World, you're writing in the future. I imagine the research process had to have been a lot more challenging since you can't go there.
Says you. I used to be a technology journalist for years. So a lot of the technology and a lot of the future tech stuff were just things that I wrote pieces on and features about back in the day. So it was a lot of stuff I saw people working on in universities and in technology labs and things. So I had a fair idea of what our future looks like, or at least I have an idea of what people are working on and want to sort of, like, you know, bring to us and sell to us in the future. So a lot of it came out of that. So that was the research. The rest of it I couldn't do because I started writing this book in the pandemic. So that's how long it takes me, but that's where it started. So where my usual research period would have been couldn't happen because I couldn't go anywhere. So I knew it was going to be on basically a Greek island. And again, I'd been a travel journalist. So I had to go back to my old articles. So I almost had to stop. My research was me. It was the jobs I'd done before. So I went and read my old travel articles on Greek islands and tropical islands because I wanted to feel the heat. Like, I wanted to feel the smells and have the sense of the water. And, like, there's little descriptors in all my travel pieces that I was like, yes, okay, that reminds me of what that feels like. And once I had that, then I could start writing. And it was the same for the technology. I went back through a bunch of old articles I'd written looking at interviews because I'd half remembered things. And reading these in-depth interviews with these people. And sometimes I went back to the research material, so the transcripts of the interviews and the bits that never got into the article. to look at what these people were talking about and look at what was exciting about it. So almost, yeah, it was a deep dive into myself, which sounds really lewd now that I come to say it out loud. But that's what the research was. It was just me spending time with me. That also sounds lewd. Everything I'm doing here is bad. And I'm very sad about it. But that was the research. And then the challenges were just the blend of things that the book was trying to do was really hard. I found with Seven Deaths, when I wrote that, a lot of the things in that sound wild, but they wanted to go together. So a repeated day and a murder mystery, well, a murder mystery kind of is a repeated day. You're constantly going back to the day someone died. That's what police officers do when they rework it and they do the timeline of it. So that stuff kind of worked. The body hopping kind of worked, because as I say, all it really is doing is putting you in the body of the witness. So that kind of worked. Devil, 1632, a boat in 1632 was effectively haunted anyway. Like they were, I think something like, I can't remember the facts about this, but I'm sure something like 30% of everyone who got on a boat in 1632 on one of these journeys would have died. So a third of everyone who got on board was going to die. That's a horror book in itself. You almost don't have to do too much to it. So those genres went very well together. This was much harder. Because, and I think you'll probably spot the flaw when I say it out loud, but I didn't in the planning. If you create a lovely, selfless, kind community of people who don't argue, there is no conflict. And if there is no conflict, there is no drama. And books require drama. Very important to the entire process of writing a book is drama. And I created a cast of characters who could never give me any drama whatsoever. So I'd planned it all out and I had everything, but I didn't have a way of sort of injecting. So what I ended up doing was creating familial relationships, because even in the most lovely and selfless and kind families will argue. They will find bones of contention. That's just what we do as people. And that felt fitting. That could work in the setting that I created. So that was the biggest challenge, I think, was taking the world that I'd built and actually sticking a murder mystery in it, because a murder mystery shouldn't have been possible. Just that's the rules I'd set out, and I didn't want to break them. I didn't want to bend them.
Just shove a murder mystery into that utopia.
Just yam it in.
Right?
Just get it in there. Just bring a bit of murder mystery.
Get out there.
Yeah, it is.
That's amazing.
Oh yeah, it's like sticking a house inside a hot dog bun. That's what it felt like sometimes. It was just like, this is the stupidest idea I've ever had, but I will make it work.
You made it work. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, winding down for part one of our chat with you, you know, you have, when this, it's always so weird when we
this one is already out in the UK and then it's coming out in the US when this episode goes live.
Okay, so it will be out today.
I believe today or next week. Yeah, it'll be out
very, yeah. Okay, in the future, yeah, when this releases. perfect. So your latest book is out today or very soon, depending. But winding down, can you tell us what you're working on next or right now? Are you in the research phase for a new project? Can you talk about any of it? Is it all very hush hush eyeball emojis on Twitter? What's the
I just suddenly realized how old I was when I was talking to you, and you were just like, I don't understand half of what MJ's talking about here. I am baffled by most of this.
I feel so young.
You know, I
you live millennial, you.
Oh Jesus. I won't talk about it, because what I'm working on right now will not be what I end up writing. So this is what always happens in the planning stage. It's all big ideas and blue sky thinking, and then it won't be that when it's finished. So if I told you what it was now, I'd be lying to you, and I don't want to do that. I'd just be lying straight to your faces, and I'd be lying to your audience face, and that would be very bad for everybody. So, and also, truthfully, I'm very lucky. I write standalones. I'm allowed to write standalones. I'm allowed to write weird standalones. What that means is that every single part of what I write is a mystery. Every single thing, not just the mystery of who killed whom. It's what kind of setting are we going to be in? Who are these characters? What world are they living in? Everything I write from page one can be a mystery. So I like to preserve that as much as I can, because I am in a very privileged position that I get to do that.
Well, he's shoving a house into a hot dog bun. We can just leave it at that.
In some form.
In some form or another.
And killing myself doing it. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, to close out, I want to ask you a two-parter. If you could give listeners and viewers, A, a good bit of soundbite writing advice, if anyone wants to listen to him, take it or leave it. But
despite the shirt.
despite the shirt.
And B, tell us a weird or random fact that you find to be utterly fascinating.
Oh, these are two excellent things. My first and only piece of advice to aspiring writers is finish the fucking book. Just finish it. Like, all I ever hear from people is, how did you become an author? And I'm like, did you write a book? And like, oh, well, not yet. And it's like, well, you're probably not going to get there, would be my thought. Like, it's very hard to sell a book on the shelves that's not been written. Like, people, it's very hard to get an agent with a book that hasn't been written. It's very hard to go to a publisher with a book that hasn't been written. So don't worry about me or anybody else. Just write a book and get it all down. And once you've got that, all the rest of the advice suddenly becomes useful. But until you have that, until you have 300 pages of something with a beginning, middle, and end, none of our advice is very useful at all. So write a fucking book. The other, and I heard this recently, which I absolutely love. Actually, can I give you two facts that I found out recently that I think
you're the first person to ever offer two.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I love it.
I love a good random fact. One, we have a good or fair to good etymological understanding of nearly all the words in the English language, right? Nearly all of them. The only one we have almost no understanding of etymologically is the word dog. We don't know where dog comes from. We have no idea why it pops up yet, just dog. Everything else can be traced back. There's a Latin, there's a Germanic, there's a something. Dog, no idea. Nobody knows. So dog, that's my first one. My second one that I found out recently, which blows my mind, is that you know Aldi, the supermarket chain?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Yeah, we're all aware of Aldi, right? We're all aware of Aldi. Aldi is not one Aldi. Aldi is two Aldis. There is an Aldi North and there is an Aldi South because back in the day, the German brothers who owned Aldi had a big falling out and they separated the company into two because they couldn't stand each other anymore. So one got half of Aldi and the other got the other half of Aldi. So in the US, I believe, and I'm probably wrong about this, but in the US and North America, you get Aldi North, and then I think in the UK, maybe that's Aldi South. And so the logos are roughly the same, apparently, apart from a change of colour somewhere. But the products and stuff can be completely different. But they both have the Aldi name, but they're run as completely different companies, different board structures, different everything.
Crazy. Because I lived in Germany, and like I remember seeing Aldi in like Berlin where I lived. Yeah, so that would have been Aldi North. And then I remember going to like Munich and seeing Aldi there, and I had no idea that it was a different thing.
You're not supposed to, but it's wild. So yeah, there's two entirely different Aldis.
Those are like the most cooperative. That is like the most cooperative dysfunctional family ever.
How incredibly German of it, right? Like it was just like,
I hate like, you about, we're going to make this sustainable and long-term for the both of us. And we're going to divide the territory and that's that.
It's like, you know what? It's the business version of taking masking tape and putting it down the middle of your shared bedroom.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Children, I love the idea that those German brothers were like, hey, do you remember last time we, the German people, divided something and that didn't work out so well?
Right.
Let's not do that again. Let's learn history's lesson, and this is what we're going to do. I think it's wonderful.
But this is like the most this is like the most amicable grocery Cold War ever. I love it.
Yeah. Yes, precisely. And I like the idea that, like, I think there's a drama to be written about this, that, like, Aldi South will occasionally just look and be like, oh, my God, they are stocking mattresses. How terrible. and then they will endeavour to work out who's supplying these mattresses to them. It'd be great. Like Succession, but boring. Yeah.
Succession, but German. And
yeah. Dead God.
Oh, my God. Those are brilliant facts. Thank you so much. Okay.
Thank
I'm never
going
to look at Aldi the same ever again. Or dogs. I'm going to look at them and be like, you're a mystery, your origins, not your like biological origins, genetic origins, but like your name.
Yeah.
What I call
your name. Yeah. Your shrouded name, in mystery. Yeah. Yeah. I think we all knew that dogs are an alien species and now we have confirmation.
Yeah. It's like octopi and dogs.
Yeah. Perfect. Dope. Yeah. I think it's the most interesting thing I contributed to this podcast. I'm really happy with the way it went.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for hanging out with them, Jen. It's absolutely wonderful getting to know more about you, your career, everything. Just hanging out. It's been wonderful.
Thanks so much. Thank you for indulging my chaos. I've enjoyed it immensely.
MJ and I are chaos monsters, so it's okay. We like
it. I'm getting that. I am definitely getting that.
Stu, could you please let everyone know where they can find you online?
Yes, I am on Twitter. or X, or whatever you choose to call it now, and that is at Stu Turton something. And then I am on Instagram, and it's probably also at Stu Turton, but I don't know. But like, there's only one of me who looks as stupid as I look, so just go and look for that guy. That's probably the best thing.
There's only one self-deprecating Stu Turton out there. And go pick up 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. Go get the new merch that Stu's putting out, Make Evelyn Live Again. And go get yourself a copy of The Devil in the Dark Water, The Last Murder at the End of the World. Some fantastic books. You can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, all that stuff, at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. You can pick up my mushroom babies. Pick up Mushroom Blues. It's available now in hardcover, paperback, and ebook. MJ, what about you?
Yep, you can find me across all the major socials at MJ Kuhn Books, all one word. Or just find me just on my website, mjkuhn.com, and you can get all the stuff there. My newsletter, my world building guide, my books, blah, 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 everything. So there you go.
Everything that can contribute to the Thorin Food Fund. He's a hungry little kitty. All right, well, that's it for this episode. Stay tuned next week for part two with Stu for a mini masterclass on locked room mysteries. We've been teasing it a lot, but we're gonna dig deeper into that next week. For now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.